love my kids. I would do anything for them. Trust me.
Anything?
Of course. What do you want?
I want a horse.
Well, hi, everybody. Happy Friday to you. This is Mark Ciappardini with the Ghost Seat Talk podcast experience. Thanks for joining us again. We are super delighted, super thrilled, super. There's a lot of heartstrings being pulled right now to introduce our next guest. James Allen Robertson is a multi-instrumentalist who has done work with Rupert Gregson Williams, Remote Control, and has his a very fine score to the modern Western drama Heart of a Champion.
I've only ever read in English. I don't know Western. Can you teach me?
Want something bad enough, it's worth working for.
I want it.
Yeah, get your girl some boots. Can't keep doing this in her sneakers.
This is about to get out of hand.
James, thanks for being on the show today. How's things in your world?
They're great. As you see, I've got my dog behind me, my little assistant, and I'm just excited that this little film's coming out today.
Excellent. Is your dog your copyist or your arranger?
My dog is he's my producer. He's my doggy producer. He tells me if it's good or not. He'll howl if it's a little dissonant or something. I'm going too loud.
Have you tried to, what's his name?
Archer.
Archer. Has Archer been, you know how some composers like to do Easter eggs or little, you know, fun things with sampling and stuff. Has Archer made his way into any of your scores in any form?
He has in various ways. I'm in my studio right now, and I'll generally track guitars here with a little mic, and occasionally you hear a little tambourine, which is his collar. Probably more so, I did a television show a few years ago, and he definitely jangled a lot over on those guitars. There's a lot more volume of guitars, so he made his way into more of a percentage of that score, yes.
Excellent. So yeah. That would be a first if royalties were... found their way to the animals in the composer's hearts.
Oh yeah, he's got a publisher already, so we're all set. You know?
Excellent. Well, yeah, we're thrilled to have you on the show today. You know, I have a daughter who's 7, and actually she'll be 8 in April, and she loves the Spirit show, the movie. I hadn't really gotten into the movie, so to speak, but she just, you know, something about horses and the little girls, it just, you know, there's a bond there. But what I love about the movie is just the heart that you bring to it with the instruments that, you know, it seems like Western music and Westerns will never go away. What were some of your challenges crafting this music using, you know, steel guitars and things that are so time tested and honored in the genre, so to speak?
Well, first of all, I hope your daughter really loves the movie, and I'm glad that she likes the Spirit riding free stuff. There, I do think there's something timeless about little girls and horses, and something about the freedom, and something about just the openness and possibilities of that. So I was very lucky to have worked on that score before I came here. I think the challenge and the real charm of it is, I don't want to say, like, not overdoing it, like not just slapping a bunch of these instruments and scoring it like a normal film, but throwing, you know, orchestra with banjo. It was more of like, okay, let's have a language. So when you first meet Charlie, they had kind of temped in some just little swingy banjo, and it was cute, but I wanted to do something where, hey, maybe it starts out with the main character a little more modern, a little small, indie, and then as the film progresses, she gets more wild and these other elements come in. So just kind of coming up with a reason to bring those instruments in other than just, hey, we're in the South, something like that.
You know, I interviewed James Newton Howard a number of years ago, and he talked about when he was scoring Blood Diamond. And I would like to think it's similar to what you're saying. You don't want to make the music feel like a travelogue, that it doesn't really have any connection to what's happening, or, you know, maybe trite or overdone. So I think that the charm in these instruments is where you place them, how you layer them. And I don't know, this is kind of funny, I'm not usually a soundtrack fan, but I found myself, I don't know if I like the songs better or the score better. So can you talk about working them into your work and what it was like crafting songs?
Oh yeah, with the songs in this film. Yeah, it was very awesome. So a little bit of the backstory is I had a very short time doing this film. They had kind of decided they were going to license a score until sort of the last minute, and then they realized it would probably be better to have some bespoke score. And part of the licensing was going to be these other songs. So all of a sudden we had about four or five different song placements to fill. So I initially started just writing lyrics and coming up with music for the songs on my own and with a writing partner. But I also realized I had about an hour and 20 minutes of score to write. So I needed to sort of branch out. And so I called a bunch of my good, I went to Berklee College of Music, and a lot of my friends who I studied with there live in Los Angeles and are doing sync music and are doing songwriting. So I just kind of called some people and I said, hey, do you have anything, or do you have any ideas that we could maybe cultivate for this? And I called my friend Hannah Ferber, who is part of this duo called Idlemind, and they sent me kind of a little, like, okay, we'll see what we have. And they sent me something that on one hand was totally wrong. It was like an 8-bit drum machine type thing. But there was something about the melody and the chords that I was like, there's a kernel here. So I grabbed it. I pulled it into Cubase. I hauled out all the low frequencies. Still, it was just the vocals and like the hi-hat. And I just layered up banjos and guitars. And I sent them that. And I said, hey, does this inspire you? And they said, totally. And then they came back a few days later. And then they had the Windswept and Wild song. And, you know, I put on some of my dobro and other things after the fact. And that's what ended up being in the film. So that's just one example of just having very talented friends who kind of get the language of film, and I can kind of steer them a little bit and say, it really needs to feel busy and frenetic here. So, you know, the pre-chorus is a lot of syllables and stuff. So they really understood the language of the film.
Well, it's funny you mentioned the dialogue that you had, because, you know, I've heard over the years that directors, you know, who usually aren't musical, they speak in things like emotion, or like you said, bigger or something like that. But you're dealing with somebody who actually speaks in, you know, the same language, the same lingo and stuff. What did you have to educate them about the process? And did you inform them that this is what you were wanting, and how that was able to align with what we ultimately got?
That's a great question, because a lot of times composers and directors want to speak in a musical language. They want to say, we need 16th notes here, or we don't need it. Almost always, if not always, fails. It's so much easier to speak in the language. It's like a recipe for being mistaken, as if you speak in musical terms. Even the best, I heard a story where Randy Newman had messed up something. They had said, we want it faster, but really what they meant is busier. So not a faster tempo, but more. And it's like, it's an easy mistake to make, especially if you're in the weeds of music. But yes, speaking with these songwriters, I really did try to keep it less musical and more emotional, and really just said, and I think it was obvious to both of us that the sort of 8-bit nature of that wasn't going to work. And so I really just tried to key off of the emotion of what they said. I said, this sounds very innocent and very, you know, and there's a way that, you know, 8-bit video game music and this country music have an innocence to them, very different type of innocence. But I'm like, can we preserve that while getting rid of the background? So kind of freedom, youth, fun, getting into a little bit of mischief. Those were sort of the languages, the words that I would sort of say to them. And then maybe the odd, like, well, what if, you know, you slide into this chord and to give it this idiomatic thing. But I really, even with someone who has the same pedigree as I do, I just try to keep it that way, because you're going to get to it faster, I think.
Well, I think of the five songs that do you call it source material or source music? Like, what do you in the industry call a song in a movie?
So it actually depends. The song The Leavin, which is on there, I believe is the only source song, which means that it's explained. I think there's I always get these confused. There's diegetic and non-diegetic music, and I always get mixed up which one is which. But, you know, if someone turns a car radio on and music plays, I'm just going to take a stab and say that's diegetic, or it's the other one. And then score, which is just not explained. It's sort of extra real. Okay. Yeah. So that's the only source song. And then the others are, I guess, they're spots, you know?
Okay.
Yes. But, sorry. Well, question about those songs.
Oh, just what do you what is the vocabulary? What is the vernacular in the films? And actually, I think you hit it on the head. So when you said non-diegetic, so like Windswept and Wild, I believe the movie opens on that song,
right?
And that's something that plays in. So that would maybe be one of those two, diegetic or non-diegetic. But then The Leaving, like you were saying, which I really like that song. I mean, I had to listen to that three or four times from the link that your rep sent over. It's just such a powerful, it just has that that it factor. Like that's a great country song. It's got a lot of good poetry and imagery in it. So
I really like how that came. There's a great story about that one, actually. The story of how that got in, that song actually existed before the film, but it was this wonderful accident. So in Los Angeles, maybe a month or two before I started this film, I met Dana B, who's the songwriter for that. And she was playing fiddle with an old bass player of mine in Hollywood. And I just happened to be out to see her. And she was studying film scoring at, I think, USC. Yeah. She was studying film scoring before heading back to Nashville, where she lives. And I told her I had done Spirit and it would be great to do a project together. Well, then just a few weeks later, this comes in. And so she is the fiddle player all through the film. So anytime you hear fiddle, it's Dana, and she's amazing. And I told her, I'm like, oh man, I got this song on my plate, you know, for this near the end of the film, there's this sort of the rival girl, Madison. And she is, she has some attitude, but she's got some softness underneath, or like you recognize that her meanness kind of comes from a place of hurt or neglect. And then she does this whole huge, like very intimidating barrel racing routine, and some music had to be playing for her routine. And I was like, I don't know what to do. You know, I need to, TBD, you know? And she said, well, I have this song. I don't know. Like, it's just out here if you want to use it. I threw it up against Picture. And I was like, oh my God, this is just, because it has that. It's Leaving. It's this hurt woman who's expressing attitude, and it's like it just worked. So I was very pleased that she could be on the project and sort of lead me to this wonderful little song near the end of the film.
It's an exceptional story, and I think it's funny too, because it does. You tend to not have sympathy or too much sympathy for a heavy or an antagonist. Or have you seen what was it? Last Night in Soho, the Edgar Wright.
Yeah.
So there's a part where Mackenzie, well, let's just say that the lead in the movie is sort of has a girl in her her fashion class who just start off being her roommate and then really quickly turn on her. It's like you tend to hate those people, like a Walter Peck from Ghostbusters. But it's nice that it's nice that you can get some sort of redemption through a song and something like that. But I really like even the last one, Keep on Rising. I could just imagine, you know, when I show this to my daughter, I could imagine her singing it with her friends. Don't want to spend too much time on songs. Let's get to your awesome score. I think I've got six favorites, just because of the different emotions that they elicit. I think My Horse Is Out There has this hopefulness and it builds really well. The My Girl's a Cowboy is very robust. And I think this almost seems like wall-to-wall music in what is a very short runtime. So I guess you said you came on late on this and they were supposed to be licensed. Other music was licensed. So how did you do your magic? I'm flabbergasted by the score.
I was thinking about that this morning, about how systematic, and it was something that I really feel like my time at Remote Control and working for Rupert prepared me for, because, you know, they do just these huge projects on short budgets or time budgets, and often large financial budgets, but trying to like make the best music to explore the most possibilities in the most efficient way. So I just really got my iCal and I just put the weeks down. I'm like, I need to have this much music by this Friday. So every Friday I would deliver them a chunk of music until I had delivered everything. And then the next Friday I would deliver the new chunk as well as any notes they had from the previous chunk. And I only got one note, which was great. I don't know if that had to do with the timing, or hopefully the quality was a large part of it. But really, because I had a temp, as you know, one often does these days, I was able to sort of eyeball spot it and just kind of see where they wanted music. But I was thinking about that this morning. A lot of times they would have music start at the beginning of a scene, play through the scene, and end at the end of the scene. And I realized that more often than not, I was doing the opposite. I was having music carry us from one scene to the other. So maybe like 40% of the times that happened, I would end up bookending them and the scene would be more or less dry to kind of dramatically connect, like, oh, this person is having a setback and it brings us to this other character who's in another situation. So at that point, the question is, who do we want to stay with? Are we coming out of the worry? Are we coming into the optimism? And had to make all those decisions very quickly and commit to them. That's the big thing. There's not a lot of time for, you know, waffling and being, oh, no, maybe we'll try this. It's just you just go and they'll tell you if they want something else. So that was a big part of it.
Well, I think what you just said made me think of something that I was thinking of when I listened to the music and watched the movie. You mentioned Randy Newman earlier, but I got the feeling that this kind of reminds me of what David Newman did for Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. Mm. You know, there's a huge difference between what David can do for Bill and Ted versus Galaxy Quest, where it's like a orchestral score that feels all, you know, full-bodied and robust. But there's something about Excellent Adventure that just feels like it's what you're saying. It's purposeful. It's there's 48 seconds of a little jingle here, something that, you know, gives you the mood and the energy, and then it just gets dry, like you said. So when I said wall-to-wall music, I felt like when I looked at your runtime, it was like, wow, this movie's only, you know, 93 minutes. And when I added up all the things, it seemed like 100 minutes of music, even though it's not consistent. So I don't know where I'm going with that, but I like the little energy that you put in, even like a short cue, like you smell like a bar.
That's a favorite.
Great stuff. Great stuff.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you mentioned David Newman. He's a huge influence, actually. The movie Serenity he scored is a great one where it's orchestral, dramatic, but there's a lot of guitars and dobros because it's based off of the show Firefly. And so that was definitely an influence over the years of doing these sort of occidental, sort of Western type scores that I seem to find myself doing. So nice to be spoken of in the same sentence of his. You Smell Like a Barn track is great because it's like this montage. And one of the things with montages is they're kind of set pieces and you kind of want them to feel like a song. You know, there were a handful of pieces, even the My Horse Is Out There one that we mentioned. And I'm so glad you used the word hopeful because that is, there's a lot of hope, but that theme is very specific to like her hope of finding a horse and it comes back later. But the, You Smell Like a Barn one is like, okay, well, there's a million ways. Like, what kind of song? Does it need to be full country or can it be a little? And that one's a little more kind of indie pop. It's we're saving the full on country for the state finals. And so just kind of having an aesthetic about how deep do we go in one direction? And is the film just going to feel just jangly the whole time? And then maybe you tune out. So there's a balance to be struck there.
I think you hit it. I think you nail it. It goes it out of the park, as they say. But you've got spirit in you. You've got champion in you. You've got a couple other equine-based properties in your profile. Are you getting to that point where you're like John Powell? It's like, okay, enough of the animated properties. Let me get something else. How's your reputation precede you?
I think you nailed it, for better or worse. It's so funny. I grew up in East Tennessee and I grew up, you know, listening to Chet Atkins and stuff. And my dad was a guitar teacher and stuff. So I had that in me, but I also felt like going to music school, learning rock guitar, learning to score orchestral, I was kind of almost like running from it or denying it or sort of being, you know, it's like a native language. And then you sort of try to assimilate and speak a different language. And, you know, like, you know, you could say, but then I just keep getting on these projects, like also on my resume, I co-wrote a score for a television show called Dead Men with my friend Garrett Wunder. And it was, you know, real, it was dramatic and it was live action Western. And then I worked with Rupert Gregson Williams a little bit on Ridiculous Six. And so it's just these things kind of come in. I'm like, well, I've got a banjo. And so it's just like speaking a native language. And then you just kind of lean into it at a certain point. But I'm glad that this Heart of a Champion is live action because it's a different set of muscles. Even though sonically there's a lot of similarity to Spirit Riding Free, scoring for live action, it's just a slightly different set of muscles. You don't have to use a lot of energy to sell the reality, so you can spend more time only on the emotion. You know, I don't have to make it seem like these characters are real. They are real. And then I can just give them, you know, the emotional sort of subtitles with the music.
Well, I can see how that makes a lot of sense. I remember, and specifically speaking about John Powell, he was like, why am I underscoring something that's animated? Because you already know they're goofy. You already know, like, their look telegraphs what's supposed to happen. So there's this weird dichotomy or this sort of impasse. Do I overscore something or underscore something? Because it's really, you know, the visuals are so strong in an animated property. But, you know, I remember when I was in eighth grade and I took a music class. That was one of the electives. And so we watched this very rudimentary music lesson where it was like, look how the music changes the profile of just this alligator getting out of the water, you know, and they did what you would expect, just like a very loopy alligator, like do-do-do-do, but then more of a menacing one and a happy one. It's just amazing how the music can change your perception of what's happening. So don't know where I was going with that either, but.
No, that's so, it's so perfect. And also it's so great that you mentioned John. He's obviously one of my favorites, and the sort of the test drive for the How to Train Your Dragon, you know, because I guess I hadn't heard that quote from him, but it perfectly makes sense. He's able to just make this just pure unleaded emotion, you know, that for this, and there's danger, but then, I mean, I challenge anyone to listen to that track without just crying and feeling proud. And it's just this beautiful thing, but he can do that because he has that sense, and he knows kind of how much do I have to lean into the animation versus how much can I add. You know, there's music can add, or music can music can augment, or it can sort of tell you the same thing. It can be parallel, or it can be, you know, it can add to what's going on. So if somebody says something, the music can tell you whether or not they're telling the truth. It can confirm or deny the words on the screen. And I always loved that about film scoring. So someone can be said, no, I'm fine. And the music can tell you they're not fine. And I love that. And I there's some of that in this film too, where someone says that, you know, they're confident, or I got it, or I think this is going to be okay. And, you know, the music's, oh, I don't know. Or, you know, we're going to see Dad and, you know, we're happy about it, but really, you know, there's some backstory that we're trying to get. So I was trying to do that in the film, because like you said, it's, you know, 93 minutes or 87 minutes or how long, but there's this whole kind of B plot about Charlie's parents have split up relatively recently. And there's a scene where they go and they meet Edward Furlong, who's playing her father. And I wanted just a little bit of, like, it's sweet and they go home, but there's a little bit of a downturn on the dad, and not that like he's bad or whatever, but that just there's some sadness associated with seeing both of them together. And I wanted to just telegraph a little bit of that, just so that we feel like almost we're getting more information about the film. It almost feels like a longer movie than it is, because more is stuffed in it dramatically.
Well, on that note, what if you had to dilute this down or do a reduction for, say, a sizzle reel or a demo reel? Like, what would you say is the heart of the score? What instrument or what motif or what cue really just says this is Heart of a Champion?
From the soundtrack, I would say the song, of course, Windswept and Wild. Like, that's a great one. I would say from the actual soundtrack, the Charlie and Chango Ride, probably, because that's actually a composite of three score cues that I edited together. But one of them is when Clint and Charlie are, it's almost like Karate Kid, where he's sitting like, do it again, you know, this moment of like things are blossoming and confidence is coming. And then there's one where she just rides off with Zach, and it's this huge drone shot of just her being free. And then the last part of that track is the final, where she runs the barrels. And all those three things together, I think, distill it. It's this journey from being this fish out of water kid in a new town to having, you know, a friend in this horse, having kind of a new surrogate father with Clint, and just having this confidence and freedom. And you mentioned instruments as well. I did try, like we spoke about earlier, to have a logic to how the styles and different things get used. I really tried to be disciplined with the fiddle. Dana's fiddle is the thought and promise and then the reality of the horse, of Chango. So you really don't get a lot of fiddle early, with the exception of this little source track at, you know, when she asks her father for a horse. And then it creeps in, it slowly comes in, and they're these very wafty, and then they, in the fiddles themselves, gradually get more confident and get more, they sneak in ways that you don't expect. There's an overhead shot where she's just kind of pacing around the yard and the fiddle lazily comes in. And it's just this hint that there's something special about this horse. So I think that track and that instrument definitely are the standouts of this film. And I was so lucky to have Dana to I wrote this thing, can you make it come alive for me? And she'd send me back amazing tracks.
That's awesome. Well, you mentioned confidence a little while ago. How and when and where did you get your confidence? When do you think if you could, you know, didn't think you could turn a corner? You didn't think that you, you know, could sustain working with Rupert or something like that. Did you have an aha moment that like, yeah, I got it now?
A few of them. I mean, working with Rupert was and is one of the best experiences of my life. And I'm lucky to say we're still very good friends. We talk a lot. I worked with him for 5 years and we worked on a handful of projects together, and really just watching him write, watching him orchestrate, watching him kind of run his business taught me a lot. And I worked with him for 5 years. And then I got, the same week that he secured Wonder Woman, I secured Spirit Riding Free. So I was going to be leaving the week that he got Wonder Woman. So I was training a new assistant during the day and then writing Spirit by night. And that period from probably November, December 2016 to maybe March 2017 was that make or break moment for me, where I'm on my own. And I literally actually lived in this room for a little while. I put my stuff in storage because I'm like, I know I'm good, but I'm not quite as good as I need to be to score 20-30 minutes of music every week and do this animation music. So that really was like hitting the gym, writing day in, day out. I did that for 4 or 5 months until I'm like, you know what? I think I've got, like, yeah, like you said, confidence. I was confident, but I wanted to make sure that I wasn't overconfident, that I could back it up. And so once I kind of passed that threshold and got that show going, I really did feel like I was off and running, not only with that show, but kind of with my solo career. That was a big moment for me. So, you know, working for Rupert helped, but having that moment to sort of like, you know, like you see the bird fly and you don't know. And then they get it. It was a few months of wondering whether I was going to hit the ground or not.
Yeah. Well, that's some great imagery. I think that sort of encapsulates the whole process, but yeah, it is exciting though, because once you know you've got it, you may get hit with a curveball. And I think that one of the things that is let's take a step back. You just mentioned 20 to 30 minutes of music a week. What does that break down to? I guess, can you describe the process of that? And how much of it is, not to say copy and paste or derivative, but like, where do you find a rhythm that you can just sort of like, okay, you're dealing with the nonstop grind, but you've got it handled?
That's a great question, because you mentioned curveball, and I think that is why I put so much into it up front. It, you know, you think about like lifting weights, and if you're lifting right at your limit every day, and then like something's up, you got an itch in your elbow, or you did something the night before, it's all coming down because you're right at your limit. And I knew that I didn't need to be right at my limit. I needed to be a little over, because if a curveball comes, right, that's the itch, or that's the slight pain that brings it all coming down. So front loading, coming up with the themes for that show. But also, yes, a lot of music. It was more like it was that much new music every other week, but at the same time, one is starting and one is finishing. So it ends up being about that much because you're doing notes and then you're doing final prep while you're scoring a new. So it was this cascade of new tracks. There actually wasn't a lot of, because animation is so, you follow things so much, there wasn't a whole lot of copy and pasting. But what I did find was for the first week, I would basically, let's see if I can describe this. The first day or so, I would try to get something down, just something for every spot, all through. Maybe the first two, you know, sketch, maybe it's a piano sketch or it's just a little shaker groove or something. Because I used to do it another way. I used to just straight through, orchestrate everything. And then I realized by Thursday, and it's due Friday, I'd be a third of the way through because I'd spend an hour on the shakers and maybe I didn't need to get that deep before I know if it's approved. So I would go through the first couple of days, make sure I had something. Then maybe on Wednesday, start filling all those things out and kind of solving the micro problems of how do I orchestrate this and make it fit with the thing that comes after. And then sort of by Thursday, I've layered in, you know, maybe I'll put some fake guitars in place. Well, then I'll get these guitars and I'll come in and really make it come alive enough to where I can send it out and they can give me notes and they'll know exactly what I'm after. And it took a while. It took a few months to have the confidence to send something where maybe it's just a full string patch on the first pass. But by the time it's done, it's layered up with, you know, it's spick and span, but they've already opined on it. They've already given me notes. So it really was a matter of, just for my own anxiety, making sure I had something sooner rather than later. And then it can all be tweaked. So that was just something I learned about myself. Other people might have different processes, but I knew that just for my own sanity, I needed to know that at least everything had coverage early. And then I would just go through and make it shine.
Well, it sounds like that process has done well for you to the point where you don't get many notes, or if you do, what are the type of notes that you get? What seems to be a common critique or criticism about, you know, when you submit something?
Good question. Well, the one note, this doesn't necessarily apply to this one. The one note on this one was on My Horse Is Out There. There's a little piano melody that I originally had as whistling. I was whistling and they're like, we don't like the whistles. All right, we'll make it a piano. So that was like the one note I got on this film. I think generally sometimes it's being, and this probably comes from the animation world, being a little too literal sometimes. Sometimes I can be like, I don't know what the music's going to be till I watch the thing and follow through. Whereas something like, trying to think of an example, maybe like White Lotus, like there'll be sometimes these moments where it's just kind of the groove, the Cuica groove with the weird flutes and stuff, and that plays through the scene. Whereas maybe if I was scoring that initially until I got the note otherwise, I'd maybe like, oh, he's turning here, okay, it's going to change a little bit, the groove's going to change, your new instrument's going to come in. And sometimes that's overthinking it. Sometimes it's just you just want a mood to bring you from the beginning of the scene to the end. So that's probably, I don't know if it's a weakness, but in some cases it's definitely like not a strength, if that makes sense.
I think it does. And I think the other thing that I was wondering is, you know, there's a lot of, when someone who doesn't speak music, a lot of times you hear the same buzzwords like epic or emotional or something like that. I just wonder if there's something that it is a buzzword that, not to say it's overdone or you're tired of hearing it, but it's like, what is the most common way to say that someone's trying to get a point across? Because I think, you know, I'm in the hotel industry, so I deal with designing hotels, and I always hear luxury, it's not luxurious enough. It's like, well, what is luxury? You know, different people have different interpretations of what luxury is. Is it touch? Is it space? Is it, you know, layers of detail? You know, like, what is it? So I don't know.
Yeah, that's so interesting. It's interesting to hear from different people's. My brother-in-law kind of does corporate designs, like facades for grocery stores and stuff, and he'll hear sleek a lot, you know.
Okay, yeah.
Clean, shiny, you know, certain things. It's funny, it varies from genre to genre, but in this, and you mentioned at the start of this about, you know, Westerns being timeless and coming back. And, you know, we have Yellowstone in 1883 and 1923, and we have all these shows that are coming out. Raw tends to come up a lot. The word, like, can it be raw? Can it be like, we want this?
Okay.
Like, that can mean different things to different people. And sometimes it's too raw. Sometimes you take that note too literally and like, oh, it sounds like you are not a professional. And it's like, yeah. No, you want to, because like I've got some violins hanging up over here, but you want to hear raw. Like I started out on violin, but if I was playing the fiddle and not Dana, you'd get some rawness, and I don't know if you would love it. I sent
like
her
a ruffian or something, right?
Yes, I sent her a mock-up one time of me playing this little thing. I think it was on the She's a Natural or something, and I sent it to her, and I'm like, can you do something like this? And she just goes, oh my, like that was her. A wonderful little rejoinder to that. So I tend to hear that. I definitely tend to hear emotional a lot, which, what emotion? You know, I mean, in general, the film tells you, but they want you to lean into how the characters are feeling usually. So those are definitely buzzwords. People want emotional, you know. Epic's a big thing, maybe not for this film. And those have smaller, and those can mean different things to different people. Dark is when you get, so we want you to go dark, but that has a musical term, and then it's got a dramatic term, and then the dramatic term can refer to different things. So you often want to ask questions about the story to the filmmaker so that they can give you more storytelling language, and then it's your job to translate that. But the more story information you have, the better job you can do.
I think for sort of the final question I have is, it's kind of a fun one. All right, so in the world of horses and equines, you never want to get behind a horse. You know, oh, Johnny, you backed the wrong horse.
Yes.
What don't you do, whether it's something that the style has evolved from musically or just like an amateur mistake? Like, what's one thing you personally never do?
That I never do musically or in a project?
Correct.
Good question.
I bring that up specifically because like this might help you out. So sure. I'm in the design industry. So there was a time in the 70s and 80s, for reasons that escape me, people put carpets in bathrooms. Nowadays, you're like, nobody does carpets in bathrooms. You know, past that, that was something. So it's like,
that's backing the wrong horse.
Yeah, exactly. And never do it again. So.
Oh, sure. Yeah. No, that makes sense. Actually, it comes down to process a little bit. I really have never been great at, and also as a corollary, don't get my best results from writing in a room with other people, having players in a room or other people like, oh, let's I tend to not like to like throw paint a bit. I like to sit and sort of sculpt a thing. And so in terms of process, if I had like a director here or something, ooh, that would be like, no, I promise it's gonna sound good, but it's, you know, really having to build stuff up that way with these instruments. And I have a very specific, very fast process, but some people don't like to see how the sausage is made, or when they do, they're like, oh, well, he doesn't know. It's, you know, there's a process here. Mm-hmm. So that in terms of how I do it, that might be something. But yeah, I would I'd say that's it. The horse that I tend to back is I tend to play in the idea on an instrument first, and then whether or not that recording stays in, that ends up sort of being the trunk that the branches grow off. So maybe the bass or guitar that started the cue doesn't survive, but the stuff around it, the strings or the piano or whatever, ends up taking its place well. So that, I guess that's the horse I back, in direct contrast to having someone in here like poking, well, what if it was that? And like, no, that's never, at least for me. Some people are great at it. Some people are, I know Lauren Bolf is great. I mean, he can just have somebody on the couch and he can make the most amazing music, and he can have people sitting around and having a conversation in the corner, and it's just, that won't, can't do it. Yeah.
Yeah, my friend likes to say, it comes from the fact we both moved to Dallas after being at Oklahoma State together. And We were making dinner one night. He goes, Mark, he goes, your chicken is so good, but I will never watch you in the kitchen again. Because it's like, just the stuff that went into it. He's like, you don't want to see Mark in the kitchen, but you'll be happy at the table. So,
oh my God.
Yeah. James Allen Robertson, thanks for being on the show. But to take us out, why don't you let us know what's going on in on your horizon, things you're excited about, or just plug anything you want. What's going on?
Yeah, I'm looking for the next Heart of a Champion, but I did just finish up helping my good friend Christopher Willis out on this movie, this Bill Burr comedy movie called Old Dads. I played a bunch of guitars and did a little bit of additional music for him, and that was really fun. He really wanted the score to sound like the sort of late 70s, early 80s rock and roll, and I just had a blast doing that, and that just wrapped up a month or so ago. So I'm excited for whenever that comes out. So I hope everyone goes to see that. Maybe the parents of the people who, I wouldn't suggest the people that are going to see Heart of a Champion, but maybe their parents would enjoy it.
Better finish the rodeo. She's in the finals.
Not my problem.
We've got to get that horse back.
We'll figure something out.
My horse is out there somewhere.